We are continuing a journey that we've been on through the life of Jesus. I say this often because I know that maybe you're here with us for the first time or first time in a long time, or maybe you're watching online for the first time. We're glad to have you online. A couple things. We are taking a journey through the life of Jesus, and it's a slow journey, started last December for Christmas, and moving our way until eventually, it'll be a while before we get to the end. Every story, every interaction, every miracle, detail, we're trying to cover the story, because he's kind of why we meet here on Sundays anyhow, right? It's Jesus. So anyhow, today's story is a significant moment in his life. It takes place, it's actually two stories. One is Jesus on a mountaintop. It'll be followed by a story of what takes place after they come down from the mountain on the main land, I guess you'd say. Not mainland, base of the mountain. So we're going to see those two stories today. And honestly, these two stories, each of them could be their own Sunday. And for purposes that we're going to tie together today, we put them into one, which gives me the challenge of getting it all in. I will try not to talk too fast like I can do. But we have a lot of ground to cover because we're doing both in 1 week. And so I hope you'll listen carefully. We're going to look at the stories today are both found in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke. And what we often do when that's the case is we kind of hop from one to the other because every story has details the others don't share. And to get the full story, you got to sort of borrow from each of them. So we're going to hop around a few times as we do. And I know that's a little confusing to follow along with, but as always, the verses will be on the screen to be helpful. Let's jump right in. Starting with Luke chapter 9 and verse 27. Today's story, by the way, begins right after the story we had 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago when we saw Jesus tell the disciples he was the Christ, the Son of the living God, that he was going to suffer and die on the cross. They didn't understand. They argued with that idea. And then he explained that he wanted them to follow him and what following him looked like. That was 2 weeks ago. We took a break last week to do Be Rich. And today we're back where we left off. Luke 9:27 says, I tell you the truth, some standing here right now will not die before they see the kingdom of God. That's an interesting statement, by the way, and it's one I'd love to spend more time exploring, but for sake of time, we're not going to spend much time there. Instead, in all three of the count, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, what happens right after that statement by Jesus is found in the next verse, Luke 9:28. It says, about 8 days later, Jesus took Peter, John, and James up on a mountain to pray. Now, it's interesting, a few things I want to observe. Jesus often got away from the others to have time for prayer. He was busy, but he always took time to get alone, sometimes through the night if necessary, to pray. And sometimes he went to a mountain. He liked to go to the mountain. I think mountains are neat places for prayer. Mountains are neat places, period. But if you want to have a spiritual experience, getting on a mountain, it just feels so spiritual. Some of you have been on them before, and you know what it's like. We've done some hikes up Pikes Peak, some of our favorite experiences. We took a few days hiking the Appalachian Trail from the southernmost tip a few years ago for about 6 nights backpacking. And up and down mountains every day. And the best part of the whole trip is when you get to those lookout spots where you can just see from a mountaintop all the other mountain peaks and the land below. And as you looked over the landscape, it would remind you of just something bigger than yourself. It was always a spiritual moment for me, whether it was over just landscape or whether it was over maybe a town below. It was always breathtaking. I could even get the same sensation on some level going over to the north side of the lake on Lakeshore Drive to that deck over there by the road that overlooks the lake below and the town. Many times I've gone there at nighttime and prayed over Cedar Lake because there's something about being in an elevated spot where you're away from just the 30,000 foot view, so to speak, you know, the big picture, to remind yourself of God's majesty and his power and the bigger picture. And getting in a space like that and talking to God is a spiritual moment. And Jesus would often get alone to pray, and sometimes on a mountain, which I think is special. But this time, he did something different. He brings Peter and John and James with him. Now, Jesus has a lot of followers. That number fluctuates from more than 70 to upwards of 120 at different times. It kind of came and went as his ministry ebbed and flowed. But he had 12 special disciples that went with him everywhere, and many more that went with him everywhere. Of the 12 he called by name, there were three, Peter, John, and James, who were sometimes invited with Jesus into a special moment. We've seen that already. Does someone remember a moment when just these three guys, in a previous story we told, went with Jesus alone? Does anybody remember? I shouldn't even ask. It'll get me depressed here. Huh? You're talking? I don't know. So there was a time when Jesus went to a house of a synagogue ruler named Jairus, whose daughter was dying, and he was invited to her house, and on the way, a woman who was long sick stopped him for healing. By the time he got to the house, the little girl had died. Jesus told him, she's just asleep, don't worry, sends everyone out except for mom and dad and Jesus and Peter and John and James, and they go into the house. And they go to her bedside, and Jesus, you know, raises her up. And he tells them, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. And for the reasons why he says, you know, not to tell could be because, you know, for her sake, what a circus that would bring to her little life. But also maybe just go with the sleeping narrative. Maybe because the crowd would mob Jesus, the ones who wanted to make him their Messiah, which meant to them a king to throw Rome out of the picture. Not what Jesus came to do. He always had to hold those supporters at bay. He had to deal with the critics who wanted to kill him. He just said, let's keep this miracle quiet for now. And they did. But that was Peter and John and James. I don't know why these three keep getting special moments away from the others with Jesus. Maybe they're future leaders and he's pouring more into them, right? Or maybe they just were, they were the ones who needed more time with Jesus than the others. They had, you know, they were brash and they needed more Jesus time. Maybe both, because sometimes leaders come from people you would never expect. I don't know, but Jesus keeps pulling these men aside and they go to the mountain to pray. How special. Verse 29 says that as Jesus was praying, the appearance of his face was transformed and his clothes became dazzling white. Wow. He has this whole glorified experience. The word transformed there in our old translations would say transfigured. This is the transfiguration, as we would say. He was transfigured or transformed. His face is shining like the sun. He's got a dazzling white about his clothes. It's interesting because we see this kind of thing after death when Jesus dies and rises again and comes around the disciples in a glorified state. Some didn't recognize him, others did, but he was even a glorified body. Paul the apostle would later write about death and resurrection and this glorified state that we would have later. Jesus seems to have it in this moment, whereas we're about to see, he's sort of between two worlds. He's there on the mountain in prayer with God, and that veil of that dimension of time that we live in a linear way that God seems outside of, that can interweave with us at any moment. He's in this space and he's having this glorified radiance about him. When I've read stories of people who have died for a period of time and been brought back from a near-death experience, they often talk about sights of heightened senses, more vibrant colors, and seeing people with radiance. And they always say the same thing, this radiant, dazzling white that they'll describe, not like, that's not even the best choice, but it's hard to put into words. They say that the radiance or the translucence is almost like, not like a light bulb, but like a radiance of love and acceptance and warmth. And you wouldn't think of those words in color or in brightness, but people who've peeked on that side of things explain that effect. And I think that what's happened here is, to the best they could describe, he was dazzling, but in this glorified state that Jesus is in. How absolutely magnificent. Verse 30 says, suddenly two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared and began talking with Jesus. If it's not weird enough, now there's two old dead dudes with Jesus, right? I mean, these guys have been long gone. No disrespect to them. They've been long gone. Like Moses was like 1,500 years ago. He's the one who was the little prince of Egypt who was rescued from the Nile River and raised in Pharaoh's house. Goes back and identifies with his slave people. Ends up in exile. Comes back years later to lead people from slavery to the promised land, brings them the laws from God to govern their new nations. They never had to govern themselves before. Moses. And then Elijah, he's like halfway between Moses and Jesus' day. He's the guy who was one of the many prophets that were famous. Others wrote memoirs. He didn't have a memoir, but he was like the epic guy who had major prayers answered, 3.5 years of things that happened because he prayed for them. Fire from heaven one time. These are big names. And they are on the mountain with Jesus in this glorified state that he's in. It's pretty epic. The transfiguration is going on, right? And so what is this all about? I don't know. Why Moses and Elijah? Of all the people that could have been pulled from history to be in this moment with Jesus, why Moses and Elijah? Maybe you don't care, but I want to offer a couple reasons. Maybe it's because of what they represented. It's interesting what we call the Old Testament. People who are in Judaism, they call that their scriptures entirely. It's nothing old about it. It's their scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, right? In the Hebrew scriptures in Jesus' day were referred to as the law and the prophets oftentimes. That's the term they use. And here Jesus is on a mountain and he has Moses who represents the law and Elijah who represents the prophets. Maybe that's why these two were on the mountaintop with Jesus. I don't know. Maybe there's another reason. Maybe it's because both of these men in their lifetime also had mountaintop experiences, right? Moses was on the mountain when God sent him back to free the Israelites, and he was on the mountain to get the Ten Commandments. Maybe it's a mountaintop experience that he had, and also Elijah. Elijah was on the mountain when he faced Ahab and his prophets. He was discouraged and ready to quit when he was brought back to the same mountain that Moses once stood on to be encouraged. So maybe they have a mountain thing where they all talk with God in these moments, and that's why they're with Jesus. I don't know. Maybe it's because they both had unusual deaths in a way. Moses was written that he went up in a mountain alone with God, and somehow they penned that he died and God buried him. How does that work? I don't know. Elijah had the chariot of fire story. So whatever's going on, there's a reason why these two men, maybe it's the law and the prophets deal, they're back on this mountain with Jesus, who's in this transfigured state, glowing with this heavenly glory. Look at verse 31. It says, they were glorious to see. And they were speaking about his exodus from this world, which was about to be fulfilled in Jerusalem. His exodus from this world would be his death and resurrection. In fact, in the last story that we saw 2 weeks ago, he just told his disciples again, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, suffer, I'm going to die, I'm going to rise again. And they struggled to understand that, but now he's talking about it with Moses and Elijah on the mountain. And it says that it was about to be fulfilled in Jerusalem. For sake of time, I wanted to skip that, but I want to just point this out. It is about to happen, but not about to happen in our journey, because there's a lot of ground to cover for us still. Even when we get to the very last week of Jesus' life, just 1 week of his life, we're going to need months to cover that week because we're only meeting on once a Sunday. You only cover so many pieces of information once a week. There's a lot that happens in that last week that will take us probably 5 months to go through, right? Well, before that last week of Jesus' life, we're getting there, but there's a lot that's going to happen that's going to take us a while to unpack. But know that really it's about to happen. Jesus has made his last trip to Jerusalem for festival season. The next time will be the last time, though we have a ways to go to get there. And so he's on the mountain talking with Moses and Elijah about what's going to happen. He would suffer, he would die, he would rise again and leave this world with a mission. Now, this is good news. I'm looking at the story thinking, good. Peter and John and James, who always had a hard time understanding that Jesus said he was going to die and rise again, they couldn't understand that. They're hearing him talk about it with Moses and Elijah. Now it's going to sink in, right? Now it's going to sink in. Well, it might, except for what happens next, verse 32. It says, Peter and the others had fallen asleep. Okay, let's not give them a hard time. Let's not give them a hard time. For one, I probably, look, when I pray, I like to walk when I pray. I like to move when I pray. Keeps my ADHD brain going. If people like to lay on the floor and pray that way or kneel by their bed and put their head in their mattress, I would fall asleep, okay, every time. So I'm not going to give these guys a hard time for falling asleep. Some of you do that every Sunday in church. I'm sorry. But anyhow, Peter and James and John, they fell asleep. They're tired, right? They climbed a mountain just now for crying out loud. But I want to give you a quick spoiler alert. I told you that Jesus keeps bringing these three guys with him. So here's a sneak peek for those who don't know. There will be another time coming up down the road when Jesus is going to bring Peter and John and James away from the others again to pray with him. Another spoiler alert, the next time he does it, they also fall asleep then too. So it's kind of an MO, I guess. But anyhow, we'll get to that later. Either way, they're on the mountain, they're asleep during this epic conversation, this epic moment. And it says that when they woke up, they saw Jesus's glory and the two men standing with him. How awkward, by the way. You ever wake up and you kind of forget where you are? Like, where am I? What day is it? I'm in my own bed, but I can't remember where I am at, you know. It's really bad when you're in a strange place and you wake up and you're disoriented. These guys woke up on a mountain, not their normal little Airbnb, and they open their eyes, and then there's this transfigured Jesus and two old dead dudes standing there talking to him in a transfigured state also. And I don't even know how long it took them to know who they were, because they didn't exactly have Facebook profiles of Moses and Elijah to go by. So they either just knew instinctively who they were, or they heard their names while Jesus talked with them. But they wake up to this sight. And I would be so embarrassed to wake up. Like, I fell asleep during prayer, and I wake up, and there's Jesus and Moses and Elijah. And did they see me sleeping? Was I snoring? I probably was snoring. And it's awkward. And what I would do in this moment is say nothing. Say nothing. Hope they don't even notice me awake. Now, if they do notice me, I'm awake. But I'm not drawing attention to myself after falling asleep and waking up midway through. But of course, of these three guys, which one do you suppose would be the one to have to open their mouth and say something in this moment? Peter again, right? We've seen this before. And so Peter can't stand the silence. He's got to do something to make it better. And so he's going to speak up in verse 33. It says, as Moses and Elijah were starting to leave, Peter, not knowing what he was saying, blurted out. I just think that's funny, by the way. Like, that's just so, can you relate to that like I can? Like, Peter's just like, oh, I've got to say something because I was, you know, it's awkward here. And I'm going to say, so not even knowing what he was saying, he blurts out, Master, it's wonderful for us to be here. Let's make three shelters as memorials, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. You know, I got some answers. You know, this is Peter. You are blessed, Peter. So he's going to say something. And here's his big idea. He's like, guys, think about it now. Special day, special memorial. One for you, Moses. By the way, Moses, big fan. Read your work. Love it. Elijah, fireman, I like you, buddy. And Jesus, hey, let's just build you all shelters, and we'll honor you here forever. And Jesus, and the others don't answer, apparently. But in verse 34, it says, but even as he was saying this, a cloud overshadowed them, and terror gripped them as the cloud covered them. You can relate, right? I mean, it's always scary. Things are always scary when your visibility is limited, when our senses are limited, right? It's like when you go outside somewhere and it's daylight, or you're outside in the same place and it's dark. Well, dark is just scarier because your mind can go places you can't see as well. You're in a building that's well lit, or you're in the same building in the dark, and you get nervous and you can't see. And when our sight's limited, you're in the fog, and as a fog descends upon you. That's what horror movies have scenes about, that kind of stuff, right? When our visibility is limited, we tend to panic. And the fog is covering them, and it's gripping a hold of them, and they're afraid. They're afraid. I mean, they just woke up to that sight. And these guys in this transfigured state, and all of a sudden a thick fog. I remember hiking in the mountains when the fog would set in, and it's so thick you're seeing the trail in front of you and nothing else. It is a little more eerie for sure. And these men are terrified. Let's flip over from Luke to Matthew. Matthew 17, verse 5, same story. Matthew 17, verse 5 says, but even as he, Peter, spoke, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my beloved, my dearly loved son, who brings me great joy. Listen to him. Now, does anybody here recognize those words? Have we heard those exact words for the most part previously to this spoken over Jesus? Can anyone remind me when that happened? When he was baptized, right? When Jesus was baptized, John the baptizer, who by the way is now dead, they killed him. But John the baptizer, when he was alive, he baptized Jesus a couple years earlier. And John would tell people later that when he baptized Jesus, that he saw the Spirit of God descend from heaven like a dove and rest upon Jesus. And then he heard a voice from the cloud that said, "This is my dearly loved son who brings me great joy." And John shared that story, and now John's gone, but now Peter and John and James have heard this voice say the same thing from the cloud that they are in the middle of. And the voice says, "This is my dearly loved son who brings me great joy." And then the voice adds three new words: "Listen to him." That's new. Listen to him. Why? Why these new words? Because Jesus is finally worthy of being listened to, finally? Is that why? No, of course not. I think it's because Peter was just yapping, memorials, tributes, you know, and Jesus, God's like, "Guys, you're the future. Jesus, my son's been trying to tell you something. He's been preparing you, because when he's done with his mission and he leaves, he's preparing you to take the reins and run forward and build this thing that he's leaving you behind, this church he's leaving you behind to do. You need to start listening. You need to pay attention to what he's trying to tell you. Listen to him." It says in verse 6, the disciples were terrified and fell face down to the ground. Wouldn't we all? No matter how big and strong we are, by the way, there's moments in our lives where no matter how healthy and in control we feel, you face something bigger than you that you realize, maybe I'm a little more puny than I thought I was in the big spiritual realm of things. In moments like that, the strongest people in front of angels and spiritual beings would just become weak. And they fell to the ground on their face, terrified. But it says in verse 7, then Jesus came over and touched them. "Get up," he said, "don't be afraid." And that's interesting. Get up, don't be afraid. Because yes, their reaction of fear was natural, maybe even wise. Scriptures say the fear of the Lord's the beginning of wisdom. Makes sense. But also it tells us that God's love, once we confront it, once we see it, it casts out all fear. And Jesus comes over and says, "Guys, you don't need to be afraid. Get up. It's okay. It's okay." In verse 8 says, when they looked up, Moses and Elijah were gone, and they saw only Jesus. Look at Mark. Let's turn over to Mark chapter 9 real quick. Mark 9 verse 9 says, as they went back down the mountain, he told them not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Now that's interesting. Just like when he told them that at Jairus' daughter, don't tell anybody what I just did till later. He says this again, don't tell anybody what you just saw until I have risen from the dead. Why? Again, I can only imagine it's because he doesn't want his fans to try to make him the king they wanted him to be. That's not what he came for. He didn't want his enemies to be more desperate to kill him early. That's not time. And so he says, guys, just keep this on the DL until later. And when it's time, you can let the word out. And by the way, they did keep it quiet. And after they died, he rose again, they did tell the others. In fact, Peter would write a couple letters that are contained in our Christian writings. And Peter would talk about this very event in his later writings. Now, it says in verse 10, so they kept it to themselves, but they often asked each other what he meant by rising from the dead. Which again, we can see things seem silly today from our perspective all these years later. But to them, it was confusing. Jesus kept talking about rising from the dead. It made no sense ever. You don't rise from the dead. I know that Jesus had raised a little girl from the dead and a couple other people, but they are dead for short times, and who knows what that means. You know, and even Elijah, they would just met Elijah. Elijah back in the old days did something similar a couple times. But that's one thing. But to die and rise from the dead makes no sense. Because logically, if Jesus was to die, there's no Jesus to raise Jesus from the dead. So it's over. So they can't understand this raised from the dead stuff yet. But once he does, it will change their lives and it will rock their world. And it has rocked our world for 2,000 years ever since. Our whole faith is built upon the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But they could not understand it yet. Now, that's the first part. There's one other thing that happens on their way down the mountain. There's one other story that we're going to skip for sake of time, basically about Elijah and John the Baptist. We're not going to talk about it because I'm running out of time. I got one more story to tell with this one. And besides that, we've also already talked about John the Baptist and Elijah before, more than once, like maybe 6-7 times, something in there. So anyhow, what some of you appreciate that. And yeah, so what we're going to do is we're going to skip ahead and look at what happens down the mountain. Mark chapter 9, verse 14. Mark 9, 14 says this, "When they returned to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd surrounding them, and some teachers of religious law were arguing with them." So here he comes down the mountain, and the disciples they left behind have a crowd of people, which is very normal. Crowds try to follow and find Jesus, and some teachers of religious law who are always around causing trouble, always arguing about something with Jesus or his followers. And this whole brouhaha is happening, and Jesus comes down to this welcoming site. If I were him, I'd be like, that's it, I'm going back up, and I would just leave. But instead, he stops and he draws close to the mealy. It says in verse 15, "When the crowd saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with awe, and they ran to greet him." Because that's why they were there. They were waiting for Jesus, and he wasn't there. And when he got close, they're like, there he is, and they begin to fangirl over him real fast, you know. Woo! Someone's like, hot diggity, it's the Soggy Bottom Boys. There, you know, Jesus and the others were back. And Jesus was like, yes, I am a man of constant sorrow. But anyhow, that's another story. No, but anyhow, Jesus comes down, and he is there, and they run to meet him. And Jesus says in verse 16, what is all this arguing about? Like, what are you fussing about, guys? One of the men spoke up and said, "Teacher, I brought my son so you could heal him. He is possessed by an evil spirit that won't let him talk." I'm going to stop right here and just, this story is going to unpack for the next several minutes. And I don't want you to miss this detail because it's important. That the story is easy for us to read 2,000 years later, like it's like, you know, I burned through the Bible in a year so I can say I did it while I drink coffee in the morning. But this is a terrifying story. What we're about to read, the details we're about to read, it's not as simple as just reading it. If you were there, it would be so scary. In fact, if they made a movie out of it, well, they do make movies out of things like that, but we call them horror scenes, right? But this guy says, my son is here, and I brought him to you to heal him because he's possessed by an evil spirit that won't let him talk. The man continues. He says, whenever this spirit seizes him, it throws him violently to the ground. Then he foams at the mouth, and he grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. Oof, terrible. He said, so I asked your disciples to cast out the evil spirit, but they couldn't do it. Now, that's kind of peculiar because if you've been around the last few months, we saw that at an earlier time, Jesus gave his disciples power to do exactly that. Remember, he sent them out two by two into the villages to spread his message, to do miracles in his name, and to cast out evil spirits in his name. And they would come back from those visits, and they would be celebrating and rejoicing that even the demons were obedient to them in the name of Jesus. So they've done this kind of stuff before, but this time they were asked to do it for this boy and they were unable to. Why? And of course, that explains why the arguing, the desperate father, the religious leaders who are always finding fault with the disciples for not being able to cast out this demon. Of course, the religious leaders couldn't do it either, but don't let them stop. Don't ever be surprised when people criticize something about someone else that's true about themselves, but let's just project instead, right? And so they're going to like, you couldn't cast them out. It's funny how the hypocrisy of that always worked. When Jesus did cast out evil spirits or demons, they'd say, you're doing that through the power of the devil. When the disciples can't do it, they're like, you don't have the power of God. Which is it? They don't care. It's not about the truth. It's about hating who you hate. And that's so true today still, isn't it? And so anyhow, Jesus comes down and there's a whole scene because the disciples couldn't help it and people are arguing with them about it. In Luke 9, verse 41, Jesus said, you faithless and corrupt people. He's just, you're so corrupt. So corrupt. So faithless. He says, how long must I be with you and put up with you? I think he's exasperated again. He's like, oh, I just want to go. Give me crucifixion now, God. You know, he's like, I'm just done. He's like, how much longer? So then he said to the man, bring your son here. Bring your son here. Now, we're going to turn to Mark 9 real quick. Before we do, real quick detail. This child is this man's only child. This man whose son is in this condition, it's his only child. I'm not trying to say it would be okay if he had more kids. I'm not saying that if the guy had 6 kids, he'd be like, hey, my son's demonically oppressed, but I got 5 others, so who cares? That's not the point. The point is, it's his only little ewe lamb. It's all his only child. And he's heartbroken and he's desperate for a miracle. Mark 9:20 says, so they brought the boy. Again, terrifying details. But when the evil spirit saw Jesus, it threw the child into a violent convulsion, and he fell to the ground, writhing and foaming at the mouth. How long has this been happening? Jesus asked the boy's father. Interesting conversation point. Like, how long has this been going on? And the father replied, well, since he was a little boy, the spirit often throws him into the fire or into the water trying to kill him. Like, is that enough that it just torments and wreaks havoc on his body? It literally tries to throw him and drown him or burn him up and kill him. And the man says to Jesus, like, you know, no more talking. He's like, have mercy on us and help us if you can. Can you hear the desperation in his voice? Have mercy, help us if you can. Verse 23, what do you mean if I can, Jesus asked. Anything is possible if a person believes. Seems almost callous if you don't understand what Jesus is doing here. Like, what a weird thing to say to this poor dad. What do you mean if I can? Is that what he's doing here? Is that what Jesus is saying? Or is Jesus gonna, in just a moment here, help the situation be good forever? But he's taking a moment to say, sir, both in this moment and for the rest of your life, get your focus off of what God is able to do and God does do and God can do, and think about your faith. This is a faith issue. God will do what God's gonna do. Can you trust him? Can you believe? And look at the man's response in verse 24. The father instantly cried out. He said, I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief. Is that not the most relatable sentence? I mean, seriously, that's so good. I do believe. Can you relate to that? I can relate to that. I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. It's what we talk about faith oftentimes. We've often said that faith is believing and doubting, but acting on the belief. That's not the best definition of faith, but it's a good description of faith. Faith is believing and doubting. If there was no doubt, it wouldn't be faith. If there was no doubt, it would be certainty. So faith is believing and doubting. It has to be there. Faith is believing and doubting, but instead of acting on the doubt, we act on the belief. Every one of us, when we have something that we don't have certainty about, can choose to act according to our doubts, because I doubt I'm gonna live this way, or I believe, and I'm gonna live this way, and both are always existent, but what we do with belief and what we do with doubt determines our actions, and it shows our faith. Faith is believing and doubting, but acting on the belief. And this father's like, I do believe. I brought my son to you. I acted on my belief. I brought him all the way to you, believing you could heal him. But yes, I have doubts. So help me with my unbelief. Verse 25 says, when Jesus saw that the crowd of onlookers was growing, he rebuked the evil spirit. Listen, you spirit that makes this boy unable to hear and speak, he said. I command you to come out of this child and to never enter him again. Very interesting command. Like, get out and stay out. Eviction notice, no take backs. You know, you're out of here. Then the spirit, this is again horrible, then the spirit screamed and threw the boy into another violent convulsion and left him. And the boy appeared to be dead. A murmur ran through the crowd as people said, he's dead. They're like, holy cow, the exorcism killed the kid. The thing like tore him one last time and left him dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and helped him to his feet, and he stood up. He wasn't dead after all, or anymore, however you want to figure that. And Luke 9:42 says, then he gave him back to his father. And by the way, how happy of a moment for his dad. Here's your son, back and better than ever. And it says in verse 43 that awe gripped the people, as they saw this majestic display of God's power. This majestic display of God's power has left them in awe. But can I just point out something to us all? This was not the first majestic display of God's power that day. Just a little while earlier, up on that mountain, was a majestic display of God's power when Jesus is transfigured in front of them with Moses and Elijah showing up. That was a majestic display of God's power. But you know what the deal is? That was a private display. No one else saw that. The crowds didn't see that, but it happened. Only Peter, James, and John this time were privy to seeing that majestic display of God's power. But down the mountain where the crowd was, where people's needs were real, this miracle in this man's life that needed something big was a chance for everyone else to publicly see what just happened on the mountain, another majestic display of God's power. Now, before we, Matthew 17:19, back to Matthew real quick. Matthew 17:19 says, afterwards the disciples asked Jesus privately. Next verse here. The disciples asked Jesus privately, why couldn't we cast out? One back here, please. There's one in the middle there, I think. There should be. Matthew 17:19. There we go. One back further. There's no verse after this? Are we missing one? Well, I'll just tell you what it says. It says, afterwards, the disciples asked Jesus privately, why couldn't we cast out that demon? That's an interesting statement because it says privately. Because Jesus publicly rebuked the people who were giving the disciples a hard time. But privately, he's going to address this situation that they ran into privately. That's good leadership, by the way, I think. You privately help somebody understand what's going on. You privately address their growth. And so they're asking them privately, why couldn't we cast out that demon? We know we have the power. We've done it before. Why couldn't we cast out that demon? And look at Jesus' response in verse 20. He says, you don't have enough faith, Jesus told them. He said, I tell you the truth, if you had faith even as small as a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it would move. Nothing would be impossible. That's a strong statement. What does that even mean? Some of us look at that statement and we're like, that throws me for a loop, and I don't even know what to do with that. Like, I can just go outside right now, Arlen, if I had enough faith, and say to a mountain, move from here to there. Okay, first of all, good luck finding a mountain in Cedar Lake. That's the first thing. But second of all, I would say this to you. Again, we've seen Jesus speak in analogies before, right? We've seen that before. Like the living water, the bread of life, the opening the eyes of the blind spiritually and physically, being born again. Jesus often used real life things to make an analogy. He's doing the same thing. In fact, in that history time, 2,000 years ago, amongst Jewish culture, it was a common idiom to say about your problems, I have mountains that need to be moved. That was a common expression even then. And Jesus was saying, if you had faith, like a mustard seed, not like a literal mustard seed, go to the store and buy some faith in a packet. Again, it's an analogy. If you had a little bit of faith, it would be like a mustard seed that is small, but it grows and spreads once it's let loose. And if you had that kind of faith, it would be so unstoppable that those things that you think can't be done, like that little boy couldn't be helped earlier, or the problems you're facing in your life, they would be moved. Nothing's impossible when there's faith. Now, we're going to look at the same exact detail to wrap this up in Mark 9. Same story we just read, but the wording's a little different here. Mark 9:28 says, afterwards, when Jesus was alone in the house with his disciples, they asked him, why couldn't we cast out that evil spirit? Same story, same exact scenario, but Mark records a different response from Jesus. Not that it was a contradiction, but Jesus said a lot of things, and Mark records verse 29. He says, Jesus replied, this kind can be cast out only by prayer. What does that mean? This kind can be cast out? What would seem to be this kind of demon. Like almost like there were some demonic forces that were more malicious and more malevolent than others, right? Like maybe there's higher devils that require higher levels of faith and prayer, perhaps is what he's saying. I don't understand it all. But Jesus is saying, this kind, you need a certain faith and you need some prayer that can only, You got to get a hold of God and get some strength for certain kinds of things. And this kind can only happen through prayer. Another passage says through prayer and fasting. It's interesting. And that brings us to our conclusions at the end here of today. That's a lot of story to tell. I knew it would be. But we wanted to put them together because here's why. Two stories, one up a mountain in a private setting that three of the disciples got to see and witness. One down the mountain with the crowd, both with majestic displays of God's power in different ways. And both were important because that's life. That's life for all of us. Life is about mountaintops and valleys. In fact, life is incomplete without mountaintops and valleys. And in the mountain in today's story, the mountain illustrates a place that Jesus got alone to be with the Father in prayer. And as I said earlier, mountains are a great place to do that. Not that you have to be on a mountain. Jesus was not always on a mountain, but he was sometimes. But it's a great place because it feels lifted up. It feels like you get that 30,000-foot view. You're away from the ground. You're away from the weeds of everyday life, up in an elevated spot, remembering the big picture, getting realigned. And those moments on the mountain are important, but so is getting down in the weeds and doing real life. You can't stay on the mountaintop, but you must go there if you're to follow Jesus. And so, two statements on the screen to take home with you, and we'll be done. First one is this: go to the mountain for what you need. When I say go to the mountain, I mean what Jesus let it mean today. I mean, go to that space where you get alone with God and you say, God, I need to connect with you. Where's the mountain for you? It could be a few minutes every day when you get your day started where you get alone before the day gets crazy and you pray for a little bit. You read some scripture, you meditate. Or maybe it's midday for you is better, or even evening. But take some time to get away from the hustle and bustle and grind of life and say, I need to get alone and have that divine perspective, that time, that part of life that gives me that bigger view of my life. Because that's important. I think going to church is a version of it as well. It's not the only version, obviously. But it's a time where we leave and come away to start a brand, every week, think about this, start a brand new week. I say it so often. Beginning a new week by coming together and realizing that we are more than just physical beings or mental beings, emotional beings with financial issues. We are also spiritual beings. And that spiritual wholeness is as important as any other part of ourselves. And if you let it drift, you don't notice what's missing. It just happens over time. But you connect that first part of the week to say, God, I'm going to come and we're going to sing songs to worship you, hear a message from your word, be with other people on the same journey. I'm going to spend time daily trying to connect to my faith in some prayer and some scripture and some meditation. Maybe I'm going to get away for a couple day prayer retreat once in a blue moon. I don't know, but I'm going to get to the mountain for what I need. All of us must do that. Because if we don't, we're going to forget the big picture. We're going to forget to connect with God. We're going to forget to get that power by which the miracles happen in our lives because we see things from God's vantage point. Go to the mountain for what you need. But number two, come back to where you're needed. Come back to where you're needed. Jesus often went alone to pray. He always came back to work. Always came back. It's fun to go to church, but there's a lot of churches out there, they just get in their little holy huddles as often as they can and lament how bad the world is while claiming to be the salt of the earth, but somehow stuck in their little shakers, bragging on their brand, Morton's is the best, and doing nothing to make a difference. And that's not what Jesus did. We get in our private homes, we want to read our Bible and pray and wall off and shake our hands at the clouds like, you know, an angry old man just be mad at the world because things we don't like, while we sit around and think we're spiritual because we're getting alone with God. Hey, get to the mountain for what you need, but for crying out loud, go back to where you're needed. Jesus always came and said, I need to bring that hope to the world. I need to interact. I need to get back in where people live so they can see the majestic power of God through the love and the answers and the hope I bring with me. Come back to where you're needed. It's the reason why the old cliche exists. Some people are so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. I don't even like that cliche. I think it's dumb. I've picked it apart recently, actually. But I understand why it exists, because some people want to live in the mountain. But we got to come back to where we're needed. But otherwise, we got to go to the mountain for exactly what we need. And so, Which is it for you today as I wrap up? Where is God speaking to your heart about? Is it time for us to have more moments in our busy? I know we're busy. We're all busy, distracted. If we're not working, there's a thousand things to get to draw our attention, from playing to being whatever. Do we need to be called back to the mountain more often? Come to the mountain for what you need. Whether it's these services, whether it's your daily devotions, both, all of the above, private retreats, moments. Get those times with God to renew ourselves and remember the big picture. Go to the mountain for what you need. But come back to where you're needed. Get back and bring God's hope and bring God's light and bring God's love to the people who most need to see it where they live. If we can do those two things, we will be like Jesus. In fact, we were called, weren't we? We were called. In our last story before this one, 2 weeks ago, to follow him. What does follow him look like? It means follow him to those spots where we get alone on the mountain and follow him back to where we're most needed. Wherever you are, whatever God's challenging you to do, let's follow Jesus.